Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Arthouse Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make arthouse, indie, and classic cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and we are in the middle of Season 4, the Arthouse Starter Pack. So this is a set of movies, arthouse movies, that are designed to be like an entryway, a gateway into arthouse cinema. If you've always wanted to know more or get more into kind of artsy movies, this is the perfect season for you. We are on episode 2 of the season, and today our movie is The Seventh Seal from 1957, directed by Ingmar Bergman. If you want to see the whole lineup of the movies we're doing this season, look in the show notes, or you can find us on Instagram. We have a post about that. That's at Arthouse Garage. The Seventh Seal is a really significant movie. It's got a lot of really iconic scenes, including one of the most iconic in all of cinema. If you've ever seen the image of a knight, like a medieval knight, playing chess against basically the Grim Reaper, death itself, that's a hugely famous scene and actually a recurring thing. That's this movie. That's what this is from. And it's a really great film. I've seen it twice now, and I'm really excited to get into it. A little more about that. Here's a little excerpt from an essay on The Seventh Seal written by a writer named Peter Cowie. This is on the Criterion Channel's website, which I'll also link to in the show notes. But this is from 1987. He says, "For more than 40 years, The Seventh Seal has been a benchmark by which all other great foreign films are judged. It launched the international career of its director, Ingmar Bergman, and made a star of its 27-year-old leading actor, Max von Sydow. The Seventh Seal and the other Bergman masterpieces that soon followed it, Wild Strawberries, The Magician, and The Virgin Spring, were as important to the development of world cinema as the New Wave in France or the work of Fellini, Antonioni, and Bertolucci in Italy. Bergman's work proved that essential philosophical and human issues could be explored on film and still reach a wide audience." So that's, you know, very high praise and I think very well deserved. If you don't recognize all of those directors' names in there or French New Wave, those are really, really big deals. So he's saying this movie is as big a deal as any of that stuff. And Bergman himself is. So we're going to talk a lot about Ingmar Bergman and his legacy and his style as we get into this conversation. But we are once again joined here by Andrew Camarillo, who's going to be here all season. He is a great just thinker on movies, and he's great at digging into these kind of, I don't know, artsy movies, for lack of a better term. And I'm excited to get into this one. So before we get into the movie, let's check in with Andrew. Hello, how are you, and what have you been watching lately?
Hi, Andrew. I've recently I watched a film from 1938 called The Amazing Dr. Clitterhouse. I had never seen the film before, but it's with Edward G. Robinson, Humphrey Bogart, Claire Trevor, and it was really fun. It was kind of silly. It's sort of like a comedy slash crime drama.
Interesting.
It was really fun. Yeah. Edward G. Robinson plays a doctor, a wealthy doctor, and he has an interest in crime and learning about why criminals do what they do and how their body reacts to doing criminal activities. So he actually becomes a criminal and meets Claire Trevor and Humphrey Bogart, who are criminals, and goes through the experience while he's what's funny is he's taking like diagnostics and like vitals on the criminals while they're committing the crimes while he's with them. But it was fun. And actually it was co-written by John Huston. So it's kind of an interesting movie. So I had fun with that.
Yeah. I've never even heard of that. Is that another TCM thing that you watched?
Yeah, that's another TCM movie that I watched, which is cool. And I had forgot to mention on the last episode that I had watched Roma and Shoplifters for the first time. They were both fun, and or the fun maybe not be the right word, but they were both very good and enjoyable to watch. So they were great. What have you been watching?
Well, first of all, really quick, Roma I love so much. I've only seen it once, I guess. I need to watch it again, but I really love Roma, and Shoplifters I caught up with late last year too, and really loved that one also. So we don't have to get into all of those, but those are definitely worth watching if you're looking for titles to see. And I think those are streaming places. So Those are great. Yeah, I have. I'm going to talk about a movie just a little different realm. That's actually, I was one I watched with my kids last night that I haven't seen since it came out. It's an animated movie from Pixar. It's a movie WALL-E with the robot, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
I love that movie. I remember really reacting to it strongly when it first came out. I've probably watched it maybe once or twice since then. It's from 2008, which seems way longer ago than I care to think about. But I tried to show it to my son last year, and he wasn't really into it. But now he's 5, and he loved it. He got way into it. I love how the first 20 minutes is basically a silent movie about this robot in isolation. And I don't know. As I get older, I really love stories about non-human characters that kind of hold a mirror up to humanity a little bit, and you see like what's human about these robots, and it kind of somehow hits harder
yourself. WALL-E was a great movie. I need to rewatch it, actually. I'm glad you mentioned it. I remember watching it, I think, when it came out, and it was really, really fun and really interesting as well. It's a great movie,
really creative, and the kind of the environmental message I think is really positive too. So anyway, yeah, I really enjoyed watching WALL-E last night. Actually, I had an interesting connection to The Seventh Seal, which I'll get to later on. I was like, oh, that's funny that I'm watching these two things back to back. But all right, I guess without further ado, let's get into The Seventh Seal.
Du aldrig att fråga?
Nej. Jag slutar aldrig.
Upp till sitter herran, han är ganska fjärran. Men din bror...
Hi, this is Blake Dean Allen. I'm a filmmaker. The Seventh Seal was my introduction to Bergman, and it's probably the best possible introduction because the stigma seems to be that something like The Seventh Seal is it's too artsy and inaccessible, but I found to my surprise that it was highly entertaining, and it was a lot funnier than I expected. And that's something I came to find with watching more Bergman, is that he had a very solid sense of humor, although a dark one. The film manages to tell a real compelling story the whole time. I mean, the performances are great. Every shot in it is like a little painting. And I think it's a story and a movie that somehow, if you can get over subtitles, is just really accessible to anybody.
Hey, this is James Basham.
I think the thing I love the most about The Seventh Seal is it shows off a side of Bergman that's one of my favorite sides of him, which is his funny, silly side. And there are very dark subjects in the movie and heavy, heavy emotions and heavy scenes, but it also balances out with some really funny stuff. I specifically think of the scene that always inspires me and blows me away is the scene with Gunnar Brynstad, who was an amazing actor and worked with Bergman a lot. He was kind of part of the troupe that Max von Sydow and all those actors were a part of, his like theater troupe. And he also does a great job in Through a Glass Darkly, by the way, so check out that. But he has this scene where Block, the farmer, is being schmoozed over by his wife, and his wife is trying to, like, caress him and, like, tell him, like, oh, I love you. And he's behind them, just kind of making fun of him to the people next to him, being like, look at this. Like, she's going to, next thing you know, she's going to say she's going to make his favorite dish. You know, he's saying a bunch of those things. He's kind of talking to the audience, breaking the fourth wall, talking to them. And there's just little funny moments like that. But that's a really specific moment that is one of the reasons I love this movie. And there's also another shot that feels very Monty Python-esque. And it's the shot of Death cutting down a tree. I don't know what it is about that shot, but it always makes me laugh every time. But yeah, that's what I like about this movie, is it balances humor and really heavy subjects very well. And I think it's just a very dynamic movie. And it's also an entertaining movie, because at the end of the day, Ingmar Bergman, he was an entertainer, and he made very efficient, well-paced movies that I just love.
All right, let's get into The Seventh Seal. So this movie, again, directed by Ingmar Bergman from 1957. And we mentioned in that intro, Max von Sydow, who the late Max von Sydow just passed earlier this year, who, you know, if you're still learning, he's someone you've probably seen in his later years. He was in Game of Thrones. He was in one of the newest Star Wars movies. When he died, actually, we're getting sidetracked already talking about him, but he's been such a huge part of cinema history. I realize he's been, I don't know, since movies existed, like roughly half of cinema history, he's been there in a big recognizable face. And this movie apparently was part of his kind of beginning, one of his big kind of breakout roles. So that's he's the main star here. We also have Gunnar Bjornstrand, and he's a frequent collaborator with Ingmar Bergman, and also B.B. Anderson, who's in several of his other films, especially these earlier ones. And actually, most of these people are kind of regular Bergman collaborators. But yeah, I've seen this twice now. How many times have you watched this movie, Andrew?
I don't know exactly. I would say maybe five or six okay. times. But actually, I hadn't watched it for years up until we watched it for this. So yeah.
Yeah, I think it was about 2 years ago or 3 years ago I watched it for the first time, and then again this morning. And it's one that it's so rich that I think I can continue to get new things for sure every time. It's almost like, well, we'll get into kind of Bergman's style and why that is, but it's just incredibly dense and rich. So I guess let's talk about what this movie is about. Basically, it's about death, sort of a reflection, a meditation on death. The title, The Seventh Seal, comes from the book of Revelation in the Bible. I looked up the verse, and it's in chapter 8 or something, and it's talking about kind of the end of the world, basically. This is set in medieval times. It is post the Crusades, and the Black Plague is wreaking havoc on Europe. And so our main character is Max von Sydow. He's a knight named Antonius Bloch, and he and his squire, Johns, have just gotten back from the Crusades, and for 10 years they've been fighting the Crusades, and they've returned to this country that's now being ravaged by the plague, and everyone's very anxious, and they're the kind of the main ones. And then there's also an acting troupe, and three actors there, and there's some other characters that come in along the way. But all throughout this, the conversations they're having, of course, death is looming over everyone because of the plague, but the conversations they're having and the things happening to them, very symbolic things happening to them, all seem to relate to death. And there's also a strong element of kind of faith and questioning the existence of God. So yeah, those are kind of the, I don't know, big broad strokes. Do you have anything else to add as far as kind of the vibe of this movie or what this is about?
I think that's it, really. It is like a darker tone, because of the plague and because of the, just the terror and fear that's going on in the community, where it's shot. It has a dark tone, but there are moments with the, that we're going to do with the actors that are quite, I think beautiful and moving and full of life. So.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as the plot, it's almost secondary to the dialogue and kind of the meditative nature of this. I guess we can spoil. It's not really a spoiler movie. If we tell you what happens at the end, it's not really going to mean much, because the experience of watching this is what's important. So I think this gets to one thing about Bergman's style, and that is the language is incredibly heightened. There's a lot of symbolism. It's very literary feeling. The dialogue is really rich. I was writing down favorite lines, and there's one scene. I basically just transcribed the whole scene because, oh my gosh, everything in this is so good. We'll talk about what scene that is. But I guess overall the plot is, he's come back from the Crusades. Their lives intersect with these actors, and they travel through the woods to get to his house. That's the short version. There's a a wife who leaves a husband, and then there's a confrontation around that, coming back together. There's a woman who's been accused of being a witch, and she's going to be burned at the stake, we learn early on, and we end up watching that whole plot through. And at the very beginning, this knight does encounter death. So it's, he looks like the Grim Reaper, basically. He's got a very round face and a black hood, and he says, well, if maybe we can put it off if we play chess, basically, for my soul. And so that's throughout the movie, they return to this chess game, and it becomes clear that no one else can see death except for this knight. But they have these just really poetic kind of conversations. And actually, speaking of that word poetic, it's one we mentioned last week, talking about, or 2 weeks ago, talking about Tokyo Story, and that it's kind of slow and ponderous, and gives you time to think. This one is poetic too, I think, maybe in the way that it's also got a lot of things to ponder and gives you some time to think through those things. But it's also, again, not really plot driven, the way, I don't know, we're used to in modern Western movies. But yeah, so I guess that's kind of the plot. Again, it's kind of hard to just talk about the plot. It's probably best if we just kind of jump into kind of one of our favorite parts, things. Some of these things that I've written in my notes are really small things that I just thought was a nice touch. And so some of them are lines. So anyway, I guess let's jump into that. What do you love about this movie, Andrew?
I really like the scenes when Antonius Block, the knight, is communicating with the death. A scene near the beginning of the film where he is in a church, and he is wanting to confess, and there seems to be a priest there present, and he kind of pours out his doubts, his fears, his thoughts, and his wanting of proof of God's existence. And we see that the priest is actually Death, and this is after we have met Death already, and Death has agreed to a game of chess with the knight. I think it's a beautiful scene and very vulnerable and very open. The knight pouring out his fears and everything that he's going through after these crusades. So the scenes with Death are very frank and honest, it seems, in many ways, between the knight and Death. And I also really enjoy the Mia, Joff, and Mikael, the acting family, and they kind of provide a respite and a sense of relief from all the questioning, the doubt, the fears. They kind of represent this living quality that's very beautiful. And Bergman, of course, was a film director and a theater director much of his life, and worked with actors quite often. And yeah, there's sort of this sense that their life is worth living, even amidst this crazy world that's really overwhelming. So I really like the scenes with the acting family, and then
I think that's great. So I like the acting family as well. So it's like husband and wife are actors, and there's a third actor, and they have a young son, as you mentioned. And they are, so I tried this time, you can almost clue into, it's so deeply symbolic that you can almost, there's almost like archetypes or something with these characters. And I kind of wrote them down kind of the way I was looking at it and kind of understanding what their character is like. So we have the knight, Antonius Block, and he's having this crisis of faith, questioning the existence of God. Joff is, they kind of in a sort of aside say something about I think on stage they were saying he could play the soul of man. And so I started thinking through, like, does he represent like the human soul? Are we going to see him kind of pulled back and forth? And we do a little bit, and kind of seeing I don't know if you could consider it like a holy war over his soul or something like that. And then the squire, I really like his character as well. He's, you can see him as very selfish. He's kind of nihilistic, I think. He laughs at everything. He's pretty lecherous around the women around him. And those, specifically the knight and the squire, their kind of dueling viewpoints on the world really set up a lot of the richness that comes out of the dialogue here, which is something I've seen. So I've seen a few other Bergman movies, actually in the movie Wild Strawberries, there's something that reminded me of that. And basically it's this professor who's aging, and then he hangs out with these young people in one scene. And there's one who's a strong atheist and one who's a person of faith. Like, he's a seminary student, and they just are going at it and fighting. It was almost that feeling of, like, by having these different perspectives, Bergman is bringing out these different views on things. But yeah, I had so much with this. I did want to mention specifically that confession scene that you brought up. That is my favorite scene of the movie. That's the one where I was like, right, oh, that's a great line. Oh, that's a great line. And I was just like, I'm just writing this whole scene down. But yeah, he says, I'm trying to just pick one out of here. But he knows death is coming for him. That's when I think he says, or maybe it's the initial chess match where he says he has one, he wants to do a good deed before he dies. And so we kind of learn that. But then we see there, yeah, the vulnerability you mentioned. He's just pouring out his heart and then saying, I want to tear my heart out. Or I want to tear, he says, yeah, so there's a few things going on here. He's saying he wishes God would show himself. And the silence of God is a something that comes up here and is something that Bergman talks about in other movies too. And he has a movie called The Silence, which is kind of about the silence of God and that just existential fear of, you know, if God is real, why won't he show himself? And that's exactly what the knight is saying here. Like, I want to see him. I want knowledge, not faith or conjecture, but knowledge. I want God to show himself. I cry to him in the dark, but no one seems to be there. Which is, again, it's one of those things where, and that idea has probably existed for centuries, right? People have always had that fear. But seeing it in such a personal, authentic way from something from such a different context than my own just makes me always feel that kind of community and just, I don't know, like I think I mentioned this last time too, just the universal goodwill towards my fellow man, like we're all in this together kind of a feeling. And I definitely got that with this scene. But also, in that same scene, he has a line, why can I not kill God within me? Why does he go on living in this painful, humiliating way? And that's like he's almost trying not to believe in God anymore, but he just, there's a nagging there that he can't kill. And it would be easier if he could just, you know, not believe in God, but it's so ingrained that he can't shake that. And so just hearing that internal struggles, it's startling because it is so vulnerable and it's such a complex thing. And it's so beautifully written. So, yeah, that's one of those scenes that it's just the dialogue is it's an embarrassment of riches. Like, I can't I think with a lot of Bergman movies, I'm like, oh, I'm going to really key in and pay attention to every little thing and try to wrap my head around everything. But there's so much it seems impossible almost. But yeah, what were you going to react to that? Yeah,
I was going to say I do think it's very rich. The script seems incredibly rich, and Bergman often wrote his own script. And I think this particular scene seems to be also from almost personal experience with Bergman, who whose father was a Swedish minister, and Bergman was very raised in a very strict and rigid way, and at times was I think treated kind of badly, and that may be shown in the film Fanny and Alexander, which is a work that Bergman did late in his career, which shows a minister treating his children in a very just very strict and almost abusive way. And I think for Bergman, there was a fight in himself, or this like war between like belief or trying to get rid of belief. And that seems present during this time, and also with the Silence of God trilogy. And I think after that, he moved into another phase of his filmmaking career. But I really, I think some of these conversations or this dialogue in this film is really powerful. And I think it comes from a lot of personal struggles and thoughts.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I didn't know all that about his upbringing. I knew that His dad was a minister. I have not seen Fanny and Alexander yet. It's been a long time, and I'm kind of watching through them chronologically, and I've gotten as far as Winterlight. Actually, that's my last one that I watched, which I loved. Definitely that's a thing that kind of goes through. I did watch, there's a little intro on the Criterion channel where Bergman, this is before I believe he passed away a few years ago. This is before his passing. He was doing some interviews and like rewatching them with a critic. And he said that he wrote this film to conjure up his own fear of dying. So I guess this is a deep struggle that he had. And he crafted this script around that. That's really interesting. I guess we can move to another scene. I had several just like little things that I thought, oh, that's really a cool touch, or kind of plays into this whole dynamic. I'm just going to kind of go through my notes, and if you have a reaction to something too, then shout it out. But one thing I noticed, like, it opens on the beach just before he starts that chess match, and we see them just lying there, and there's just these still shots of them, like, I guess they're asleep. And actually, it seems like for a moment they might be dead already, then they wake up and have a conversation. But this is the knight and the squire. But that first shot of the knight laying, it reminded me of a modern movie, and that is The Lighthouse from last year from A24, that film from, I'm blanking on the director's name, who also did The Witch, Robert Eggers, a few different Eggers. I know he is someone who's very influenced by Bergman. There's a great, actually, a podcast with him and Ari Aster talking about at great length about Bergman and his close-ups and stuff. But I could definitely see just reminding me of the influence there of, have you seen The Lighthouse, Andrew?
No, I haven't.
It's a modern film, but he shot it on, I believe, on 35 millimeter. I'm not sure what film, but it's almost square and black and white and very different movie, but you can definitely see the influence of Bergman and there's several shots of people on a beach lying very still. A few very memorable ones in that movie that I immediately thought of when I saw that again. So that's an interesting one. Go ahead.
I thought that was a very powerful opening when we're seeing the sky and then seeing like a seagull sort of just hovering. And then the voices, the kind of like call of the soundtrack is just incredible. And then we hear like the lapping and pounding of the waves against the beach. Mm-hmm. And it almost seems as we're seeing them, the squire and the knight lay on the beach, it feels as if it's almost like the end or the beginning of the world. Yeah. And I think mm-hmm. Bergman really uses this sense of the water and the beach to kind of like begin the film in a way in which we are given a fresh slate, something mm-hmm. we can just drop some preconceptions or ideas about what this film will be and then kind of start fresh with the film. And I really like that opening.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think it almost seems like, where did these guys come from? They just wash up out of mm-hmm. the water. I think that's a good way to say that. That's really interesting. So it kind of goes from there, and it there's a voiceover reading that Bible verse that the title comes from. And then death shows up and he's, you know, very imposing. One thing that's interesting about the chess, I read that the idea of death playing chess is something that's actually previously in some artwork that Bergman saw, and specifically in cathedral art. In that same video intro I mentioned, which I'll link to, if you have Criterion Channel, you can check it out. It shows a shot of the art that he's talking about. So he was influenced by that, and then as they start right before they play chess, the knight says, "You play chess, don't you?" And Death says, "How did you know that?" He says, "I've seen it in paintings and heard it in ballads." So it's kind of a little reference to that. That was an interesting background that I learned in researching this. But what you mentioned, that feeling of like the end of the world, and I think that, I mean, the Seventh Seal, that title definitely references that. But they, a few times as they're talking to people in the bar, and you hear some different conversations and from kind of side people, like people are really wondering if this is the apocalypse. And a little more just the research that I did, I read an essay a different one, which I can also link to, also from Criterion Channel or Criterion Collections website. But it talked about, this came out in kind of height of Cold War, and there really were fears that that could be the end of the world in the late 50s. And so it was almost a reaction to that he's setting this story in the time of the plague and having those similar fears kind of coming back up. I mean, I'm watching this now. So this is 2020, coronavirus is raging right now. And it was interesting to get into this movie about a plague in the middle of this pandemic that we have. But I turned it on. I was like, oh yeah, this is about the plague. This might be kind of hard to watch. But yeah, that feeling of the end of the world, it comes in many times, and like whether this is the end of all things. Another point that was made by the same essayist said that that's a genius move to put this in medieval times, because if he had just made a movie about 1957, it would have been very dated, and people would have, it probably would not have had the impact. Today, it would not feel like a significant thing, but by changing the time period from where he was at, it made it much more universal, and I think gave it that lasting power. Mm-hmm. And he did other medieval stories too, so that was not an uncommon thing for him. But yeah, so that opening is really great, and that apocalyptic language comes in right at the beginning. Moving forward a little bit, there's we meet the acting troupe, and they're kind of all asleep in their cart. So first thing, when Joff first wakes up, he slaps a fly on his forehead. It's a really short little moment, but I'm heightened and I'm thinking about death, and I'm like, oh, he just killed a fly. And then later on, they say people are dying like flies. But that was just a nice little touch that, like, really death is all around us. there's things dying all the time. It's an important part of life. Just a way to kind of bring that to mind. But then immediately when he leaves, he wakes up before everyone else. He goes outside and he sees a vision of the Virgin Mary and baby Jesus. And there's this amazing close-up. There's several amazing close-ups in this movie. But as he's witnessing that, and the music swells, this kind of miraculous sounding music. And then we learn that he is someone who has a lot of visions like this, and he sees apocalypse or just spiritual things like this. And so that's just an interesting thing. And then I noticed this that I didn't last time. The first time I watched it was just a few minutes later. He's woken up his wife. We see the baby for the first time. Their baby, Michael or Mikhail, however you pronounce that. And we get another close-up of Joff that looks very much like that first one, but just a little bit less, showy, because that first one is really a big zoom in and he's got a big smile. But it's almost a parallel shot, and that music swells the same way, just a really minor touch of the music. And it's, to me, that kind of suggests that we're seeing his family for the first time, his wife and child. And I think it's just pointing out the miracle that love and new life is. So I thought that was a nice little parallel there that I didn't pick up on the first time I watched it, and a nice use of music there. But yeah, that was a nice moment early on. Then as we move forward, we're not going to go through every scene of this, but the beginning of this movie had so much that I just really connected with.
Enjoyed the as an audience getting acquainted with Joff, his wife, and their son. As well, you mentioned earlier the third person in their group, the actor Scat, I believe.
Yeah,
and sure. He has this sense of this vanity, mm-hmm. I guess, where he, after Joff wakes up and his wife and their son, Scat comes out of the wagon where they're staying and puts on a mask that is like death. And he is using this mask and turns at one point and almost addresses us, the audience, straight at the camera, and speaks as if he's death. And that it was a very powerful moment, and very slight, and it only lasts, I think, maybe 5 to 10 seconds, and then we're back to everything's normal. But for a moment, like the fourth wall is kind of broken, and we're being looked at, it seems. And yeah. I think that's a very interesting a moment in the film. And his character his use of mask, he wears a lot of, I think, fake beards, and that will come into play later in the film. When the mask is taken off, it almost seems as if he's more vulnerable. And in Bergman, from what I've seen, masks seem to be very important. And when people don't have them, there is this sense of vulnerability and this sense that they could be almost overwhelmed by life.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting. That mask, it ends up kind of hanging out in the background a little bit too later on, and you kind of see it's almost like death is just hanging over everything they're doing, and this fear of death and this idea that it's always there. Moving on a little, so before we get to that confession scene, there's actually another scene that I really love, and that is between the squire, Johns, and the church painter. There's an artist who's painting the inside of the chapel that this confession scene takes place in, and I love the conversation they have because it's kind of about art and an obsession with the macabre and why do people like art around death and that kind of thing. And they talk about the dance of death, which ends up coming back towards the end here of the movie. When death comes for people, he dances off with them, and that they all dance together. And then the squire says to the painter, you know, people aren't going to look at your paintings because they're, you know, they're so dark and sad. And he says, I love his retort. He says, yes, they will, because a skull is almost more interesting than a naked woman. And I thought that was a funny, especially speaking to the squire, who we've already seen, he's kind of a lecherous guy. So that really spoke to him well. I thought that was a funny line. But then also just already critical of the religious establishment too, because a few minutes later he says, Johns points out that maybe the point of this art is to scare people into the arms of the priests. And so it's almost like a fear-mongering idea. So you kind of start to get a little criticism of religion right there towards the beginning, and that continues to play out a little bit as well. And then also on a religious side, in that same scene, he mentions that some people think the plague is a punishment from God. And that is something that carries through as well. And just thinking about how God works, basically, and the way people think at this time, that is really fascinating to play out as we keep going, which we'll come back to that idea, I think. But do you have any thoughts on that scene?
Yeah, that scene I think was really well done. I think the painter is a reference to who you were speaking about earlier, the Swedish medieval painter who created the scene of death and the knight playing chess together. I really enjoyed the back and forth. The squire often, Johns is often the quick wit among everyone in the film, but he's kind of met his match in a way with the painter. But they end up enjoying each other's company. And there's a line a little bit later on where John says, our crusades were something like so stupid they could have only been created by an idealist, a true idealist.
Yeah, I love that too. That's a great line.
So that was a great line. And sort of the cynicalness, but also the earthiness of John's makes his character quite interesting. You're right. It's very sort of an opposite view of life, or a dichotomy that's compared to the knight, who's very austere and ascetic in ways.
Yeah, the squire almost, he just laughs at everything, thinks everything's a joke a little bit, and kind of nihilistic, I think, is the word I mentioned a minute ago. And I think, but at the same time, he sticks up for the vulnerable in a few different places, and I think that's an interesting part of his character too. He's not an evil person, it would seem, but yeah, so you mentioned the talk about the Crusades, and so I guess it goes from like the church painter and the squire talking, and then to that confession scene that we talked a lot about, and then it kind of comes back to them again, the painter and the squire, and they're talking about the Crusades, and he has that line you mentioned about, it's so stupid that only an idealist could have thought it up. But he also, like, before they say that line, he just talks about what they were doing, and basically he's like, he has this list of like, we were, you know, on the verge of death, and eating rotten food and also right. like it sounded he kind of makes a vague reference that maybe they were like mistreating women as they were going a terrible thing, and then he pauses and says, "For the glory of God." And so another just moment of that kind of critical of religious establishment and saying, you know, here's all these things we did in the name of the Lord, and just playing into the overall, you know, questioning God, questioning religion, are those the same thing, and all of that. This I think another thing that's poetic about this maybe is that it opens up so many questions and doesn't really answer any of them, but it definitely leaves you with an impression. So yeah, I like that line a lot. Yes, I guess we can move on. Well, here this again was the next scene. But they go out of the church, and there's a woman there who is, you find out, is set to be burned at the stake. Supposedly she has had sexual relations with the devil, and that's why this plague is happening. That's what they're blaming it on. So this made me think about just a greater thing I've been reading about and thinking about. Is this idea of I'm gonna steal this term I heard from Richard Rohr, who's a writer, Catholic writer, that I really like a lot. But he talks about ultimate causality, and that being the way that people, Christians, up until not that long ago, and some still do, kind of view the world as something good happened, and that we give that to God. Something bad happens, we blame it on the devil. And of course, that's a man-made construct, but that's that kind of thing is used to control people even. And so I think like things like witch hunts and burning this woman at the stake, like, oh, this must be her fault, we're going to blame it on something. And that gives people comfort that, well, we figured it out. But then, so we're saying that the devil's causing it, and then other people are saying that God is causing it as a punishment for people not being devout enough. And then I think that kind of transitioned into the scene that's a few minutes later, is the stage play. We do see the actors on the stage, and that crowd is heckling them a little bit, but they're singing this song about the plague and kind of poking fun that this is the end of the world. And then in the middle of this procession of monks and they're self-flagellating and they're moaning and mourning very loudly, comes in and just drowns it all out. And this is a really striking scene. And so the church painter mentioned that these people were going around, and he says, "I hate it. I hide in the ditch whenever they come by." So we see them. And first of all, the fact that we have this kind of lighthearted poking fun at everything from the actors, and kind of see right. their view of life getting completely drowned out by the fearmongers who come in, just kind of makes a statement about the world and about religion, I think. And then this guy speaks and says, you know, you people are debaucherous, and this plague is happening because of that. So yeah, again, that ultimate causality of we want to ascribe meaning to this from a powerful force outside of our control, God or the devil or whoever. And those things are always going to be at odds. And I think it shows the folly of that way of thinking. So I thought that was an interesting thing to see in a movie, because you don't see movies about that kind of thing very often. But I thought that was really an interesting thing. Go ahead. Yeah.
I really like that scene, because you're right. It begins with the actors kind of poking fun at sort of the way some people engage with the plague. Mm-hmm. And then it's just interrupted by this massive procession of these religious people and those who are trying to almost purge themselves of guilt and rid themselves of the shame of potentially causing this plague. And they're flagellating themselves and really, harming themselves. And it's a very powerful scene. And Bergman shoots it in a beautiful way as well. And there are those in the crowd that kneel down, and they seem to be experiencing religious ecstasy, while it's sort of like showing the madness of those experiences. It is also showing, I think, the appeal to some through this religious ecstasy or this purging of guilt or shame, to some extent, even though there seems to be, you know, that you're at a certain point that's not sustainable, right. And then you don't really have anything after that. But yeah.
And I think Bergman is okay with the paradox of that like this is meaningful for people, but at the same time pointing out that it might be folly for others. And yeah, I think that's an interesting thing.
Right.
Bergman really goes there and is okay with having all those kind of conflicting ideas in the same moment, I think.
Yeah, and also, yeah, it's just when the priest, I believe, speaks, and you were saying that he points out people and their folly and saying, oh, this is caused because of you. I mean, that is incredibly dangerous. And I think the Seventh Seal is very some of the questions and ethical questions raised in the film are still relevant. And yes, it's an older film and it's about the medieval plague, but it is raising existential questions and also social, political kind of questions and religious questions, like what ethical concerns that really matter. And I really find that moving. And I think that Bergman, this film, The Seventh Seal, is sometimes seen in a historical light, but I do think it has great vitality. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still a really great film to engage in today and to go back to over and over again.
So. Yeah, I think one of the essays I saw was saying, on paper, this sounds really not like a fun thing to watch. And fun isn't the word, but it is, it's a huge... vitality, I think, is the word you said. It's full of life. So, and I think we're making it sound maybe too like it's really heavy, and it is heavy. But there's also the moments of lightness and moments of beauty, like you mentioned. So, even in the middle of all of this that's happening, like in the middle of the stage play, we see that third actor going off and basically being seduced by like a groupie or something. We later learn that she is married to someone else, and like that ends up being a bigger deal. But the scene of their first connection is funny, and also Bergman is concerned with like these universal things, like there's how beautiful is a little newborn baby, and we see this child running around. There's a beauty in sexuality that is, it's a universal thing. Like this is hundreds of years ago, but sexuality, there's still the spark of that kind of thing, even in the midst of all of this too, in the end of the world. And so I think he's just concerned with like those overarching human experiences, and that all comes in even when it's serious or funny or all of those things. Let's see, so we can move forward a little bit in the plot, but my notes taper off a little bit from here because it comes a little bit more plot driven as we kind of watch things happen. There is an interesting scuffle between that woman and her husband and this lover, and they have a fight at the end, and there's actually a really funny scene there too, where someone fakes their death. And so there's another this movie also kind of comes at the idea of death from all the different angles it can, and so it's like if someone thinks they caused someone else to commit suicide, what's that doing to their brains versus seeing someone actually die. And so I guess kind of fast forwarding close to the end, there is that scene of the quote unquote witch being burned at the stake, and that plays out. And in that moment, so we've had Antonius Block here just in anguish thinking about, is there really a God? Is this all nothingness? And when we die, is there anything there? And he's hoping against hope that there is. And the squire on the other hand is saying, no, probably not. This is what there is, and life is what it is, and we can just laugh about it to make time pass, basically. And the scene where she is finally up on the stake and they set the fire is incredibly moving, because they he says, I want to look in her eyes and see, if I can see anything there that points to, the fact that there's more. Is there something more? And the squire says, look in her eyes, she sees the truth that there is no God. And he says, I think the phrase, her terror is ours, just kind of pointing into this like greater universal existential fear of, you know, what if this is all there is? And the squire saying, yeah, look, you can, here's the evidence right here. So I think that's a really interesting scene there. Yeah, go ahead.
That scene is very powerful. I also, in part of that scene, the knight sees the distress and the pain that the woman is experiencing, and seems to give her some sort of medication or some sort of substance that he said will ease the pain. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it seems as if she dies before she has to be burnt, which is almost like an act of kindness, and how I experienced that gesture. But it was really a very moving and intense sequence. But the knight throughout the film, the knights want to have a reprieve and have this sense of creating an act in which he can feel is meaningful in his life is very important. And I think we see that towards the end of the film when he creates sort of this protection. So that's a very amazing experience, even though he has this sense of detachment, it seems, or this seriousness and austereness and this his own questioning, and he seems isolated from everyone else in a way. Mm-hmm. He also is engaging, I think, in ways to be considerate and kind when there's an opportunity to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's well said. And that burning scene is probably the most intense, maybe darkest moment in the movie. I mean, it doesn't exactly get happy from there, but that's probably the darkest point. I guess I have kind of just two more things I want to mention as we talk through the movie, and that is so from here they do get on to Block's house. He's been away for 10 years in the Crusades and hadn't seen his wife in such a long time, and I thought that was an interesting connection. So if you've been listening through the podcast, we did an episode about the movie The Best Years of Our Lives, so very different context, but there's a very similar feeling of they're coming back from World War II, and he's seeing his wife for the first time. I thought that was an interesting parallel that I couldn't have planned, but it's, again, a universal experience. You know, this is medieval times. That's it, set in the late 40s, and just seeing those universal human experiences, making those connections is an interesting thing. And then the movie ends with death does show up, and basically shows up for all of them. They can all see him at that point. And then we see Joff and his wife and their child, who they have the previous night have kind of run away. And we see them pretty happy, pretty hopeful. And he looks over and he sees the troop. And there's a really iconic shot there of the Dance of Death. And Death is leading them up this mountain, and they're kind of doing this dance with their figures against this skyline, and it's a really moving scene, and that's kind of where it ends. But the thing I wanted to mention was, again, to say there is lightness, there is beauty and hope in this movie. I think one of my favorite things is actually way back towards the beginning, toward the middle, I guess, shortly after Block and John's meet the actor, Joff and his wife and their family. They have this lunch together, and or dinner, I guess. And all they have is wild strawberries and fresh milk. And they kind of make a big deal about how they got it. And they're saying, you know, it's a modest lunch, but look at us. We can all share this together. And it's almost like a communion, like in church.
I think this is my favorite scene in the film. Yeah. I just wanted to say that it's a very moving scene. Amidst this a really dark experience, there are moments of light. And for me, this represents this community, this sense of interconnection with others. And as you were describing, offering strawberries and fresh milk. Strawberries in Sweden are really connected to summer, and summers in Scandinavia, I think, on doing some research, last at times 5 to 6 weeks, maybe 7 weeks. So it's very short, it's very precious. So for this family, who are actors who don't have much money, who have very little to offer, to share these strawberries and milk with this, the knight, the squire, and the woman who seems to be mute, who the squire has found earlier in the film and just traveling with them. It really is moving to me when Mia, the actor, the mother of the child, she says to the knight, you know, do you have a love? Do you have like a partner in some way? She kind of is asking about that. And he says, yes, but I don't know, you know, if she's alive or what's going on. He, you know, he hasn't seen her in so long, and that's where he's headed. And then he goes into, she kind of acknowledges he and sees that he seems sad, and he acknowledges, yes. And the burden of faith is very heavy. Mm. There's this weight to his experience and what he, the questions he has and this doubt that he has. But then he says, but everything seems, that seems very far away now and seems kind of inconsequential. And I transcribed this. He said, I will remember this moment, the stillness, the dusk, the wild strawberries, the milk, the Mikhail sleeping, Joff with his lyre, the evening light on your faces. I'll try to remember what we spoke of, and I'll hold this memory in my hands like a bowl of fresh milk full to the brim, and it will be a sign for me and a source of great satisfaction. So to me, this is an incredible moment where the character is just really connected and enjoying life. When in much of the film, it seems like a struggle, and he is obviously playing chess with death for his own life. But the recognition that these people are helping him and he is helping them in a way, because he offers to take them to his castle where they will be safe because the plague is spreading. And he suggests to the actor, don't take your family in that direction. It's very dangerous. Come with me through the forest to my castle. Mm-hmm. It's this, this friendship and this just basic human connection that's very moving. I love this scene. And it's very lyrical and very kind of, it's set in this idyllic pastoral setting that is very different than much of the film, but it kind of provides this sense of enjoyment of life while going through so much that is so difficult. And I think for Bergman, I had read that he really felt like community was important early in his filmmaking career, and that he wanted to feel connected and he wanted to be heard and seen and to hear and see others. And that sense of community really drove him in much of his early work. I love that scene. I'm glad that you had brought it up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so, so great. I love that moment where he says, you know, I have so much to worry about, but it seems so far away. Yeah, like it's how insignificant all of a sudden because of this beautiful moment. And then kind of at the end of that scene, he drinks from the milk bowl again. It's just one big bowl that they're sharing. And I think it must be intentionally calling to mind a communion, like they're sharing this bowl. And I think so that the implication there is like, this is a holy thing. So that's interesting for you to say that about Bergman and the idea of community. And that's something that I feel like I've been, and maybe again it's coronavirus and being so isolated, but just realizing that community is a really important thing and a spiritual thing. So that's another just really nice kind of universal human experience kind of a moment. But the other thing I want to say about this is actually the scene that reminded me of WALL-E, and it was that same idea. Again, this may be just watching these in light of COVID-19 and being so alone for a while. WALL-E's isolated, right, at the beginning of that movie. And so when he finally meets someone else, it's a really big deal. And then we see that connection. And it's that thing I said about seeing humanity in non-human characters. And that's kind of what you get at the end of WALL-E is for a moment, it seems like his memory is erased. And it's really tragic. Like he was crushed and she has to rebuild him and all this. And then when she touches him, that connection sparks his memory. And it just is like that connection is a part of what makes us human, a big part of what makes us human. And so then watching Seventh Seal this morning, I watched WALL-E last night and Seventh Seal this morning, having that same connection is like, community is so important, and it really is a spiritual and beautiful thing. So maybe that's the best thing to leave in your mind as we have talked through this movie. Do you have anything else to say about the movie itself? And we can maybe talk a little more about Bergman and his place in cinema history, because he's a big figure.
Yeah, I think maybe two more scenes, quickly. I think we referenced it before, the The knight does take action in the game of chess to kind of allow the actor family to escape potential doom and death. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a reprieve for him. And he is satisfied with it. Death actually asked him, like, you know, was that worth it? Did you feel good about that? Mm-hmm. Or, and he was like, yes, you know, it definitely was. So he, I think that was very meaningful to the knight in the film, the sense that maybe, well, he knows, I think the death says, on next move, you're mated and the game will be over. Mm-hmm. And your life will be taken. He's aware that this is the end, but if he can do what he can to help others at this time, that's very, very important to him. And he's able to, in some small way, do that. And I think that's a very meaningful scene as well. Yeah. And then at the end of the film, near the end, I think when we see the woman's face who hasn't spoken at all, and yes, she finally says, "It is finished." She sort of looks towards, they're having a meal, and she looks towards a window, and light is pouring in to this dark kind of almost, this dark castle. And she seems almost welcoming death as a friend and being open to the experience of, I mean, I think the plague had been so hard and so much horrible, and so many horrible things that had happened to her, probably, you know, her story seems like it would be a very difficult life. She's welcoming death in the end in some ways as a sort of, maybe there is something else, or at least this will stop because life has been so horrible. And I think that that's really important, that women in this world are really victims and really mistreated during this time in history. And I really love this film, and I like some, it's not my favorite Bergman film, but I think it's a great film. And I think that the performances are amazing. I did sort of hope on rewatching it that there would be more exploration of the female characters in the film and their roles, and it's sort of showing more nuance to them. And that's something that I think is important. And later in Bergman's career, we'll talk about it, I think he does a better job of that. But yeah, this was an amazing film. And then the last thing I guess say about the film, the ending, seeing the dance of death, Joff has another vision that's just the characters on the hillside being led by death to the dark country, as he says. And it's very moving. But there also is his wife, Mia, and his child, and they're together, and she's just smiling at him, and she's holding the baby, and it's sunny, the storm has passed. And then his vision is over, and he goes back to his life with his wife and child, and they continue onward with their wagon.
Yeah.
And life continues. And that's amazing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I had a sense then, too. You know, it's like, okay, what happens next? You know, the plague doesn't wipe out the entire world. Like, it is a really hopeful ending, I think, ultimately. And like you see, death is a part of this life that we all live. And there's a lot of different responses to it. But I think, and I'm really interested in the idea of the death of the dance of death, and like learning more about that. But on the surface, it seems like maybe it's, death is a beautiful part of life, even though it's a hard and scary thing. And, I think there's a lot to unpack there. But that scene you mentioned too, where they all are seeing death finally at Block's house, and we do have the moment where the woman says, "It is finished." So first of all, that close up there is really remarkable, like right before she says that. But you also have a shot of everyone, and they all have kind of different responses. Like you said, like she's welcoming, she's almost like, and then the knight is in the back, and he's sort of praying out loud, like, please don't let this happen. And then others are just stunned. And that's a really powerful scene as well. So yes, all great things there. This movie is so incredible and vital, as you mentioned. And I think it has so much to say for anyone at any time period. Like, as you mentioned too, about the female characters, I think it does. So it is concerned with the vulnerable, right? But and it shows that there's a few moments here and there throughout the movie that people are in a vulnerable state, and there's empathy there for them, which yeah, it's important. But yeah, I agree that the female characters are pretty much sidelined. And I'm curious to see as I watch more Bergman films how that does change over time. But yeah, so that's The Seventh Seal. It's a landmark for a reason. It really is incredible. And watch it if you haven't. I don't think anything we've said here will spoil it if you haven't seen it. I think it hopefully will only make it a richer experience. But I would say if you go into it, don't expect to understand everything or expect to, you know, be a master of this movie. I don't think it's possible. I think that you're going to hear different things every time you watch it and come away with something else. But something about it will sink in, and it's an incredible experience, very spiritual experience, I think, to watch this movie and really kind of surrender to it. But yeah, so that's The Seventh Seal. Let's talk about Bergman a little bit more. So we got into him a little bit, but so he does have, several movies, 50 or 60 movies, and several of them deal with, as you mentioned, kind of the silence of God and being concerned with the existence of God and all of that. I have not seen a lot of his later movies, but it sounds like he gets into more personal filmmaking. Do you have anything else to say, I guess, about Bergman's kind of impact on movie history a little bit?
I think Scorsese had said something like, if you were a teenager in, you know, during the time when The Seventh Seal came out, you couldn't help but be, and you were interested in cinema, you couldn't help but be influenced by Bergman. Mm. And Bergman had admirers and people who really spoke highly of his work, from Federico Fellini, Satyajit Ray, Godard, Kurosawa. Kubrick has said some things about him, like he was an incredible filmmaker. Wim Wenders, and now more contemporary filmmakers like Noah Baumbach, I believe, Greta Gerwig, Olivier Assayas, the French filmmaker. I think they're an enormous impact. And I think you mentioned like the close-up shots. Those are really powerful. And then the dialogue, the nakedness and vulnerability of the dialogue and the emotional expression and the power and the psychological just awareness of the characters and the interplay between them is really incredible. And allowing the characters to explore those at times overwhelming emotions or the doubts and fears that creep in.
Yeah, it's interesting. So on the dialogue, I just want to mention briefly, like something about it. Yeah, that the nakedness and like it feels so alive, even though it's, you know, decades old now that it was written in a different language and all of that. It reminds me of reading Shakespeare, honestly, which, you know, is hundreds of years before our modern era, but there's something so alive and human about the conversations there. And Bergman was a stage director, and so I think there's an interesting connection there. And some of his early movies do feel, you can feel the staginess of it, and how dialogue heavy it is, that it feels theatrical in that way. And so I think that's one of the great things for me about Bergman is that dialogue and that kind of universal feeling of it. Yeah, go ahead.
I really agree with all of that. And I think as his films progress after the Silence of God trilogy, which is after the film The Silence, his filmmaking explores different things, but there are relationships that are explored, scenes from a marriage, Fanny and Alexander later on, family dynamics. He is exploring, I think, his past, but also just the dynamics between people and their relationships, be it familial, romantic, or just friendship. So, yeah, I think his films go in that direction overall from that point. And they also become a bit more, at times, experimental with films like Persona. I think that Bergman, what you said earlier about his connection with the theater and working in theater for such a long time, there is this sense of the stage and theater is in the film. Like there are often films about actors, or actors play a prominent role in the film. And he seems to handle and engage with his actors in a great way. And similar to the filmmaker Ozu, who we have spoken about, he uses the same actors quite often in his films.
Yeah.
And that allows for this this growth over time in the relationship and the dynamic between he and the actor that has so much richness, and you see that comfortability on screen, and he's able to get these incredible performances and these very vulnerable performances from many of his actors. And I think they bring out the best in him as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was thinking through like the ones that I've seen of his film. So yeah, Winter Light is actually the last one I watched. I liked it so much that I was like, I need to take a break before I get into another one. And I've put it on pause for too long. But Winter Light, we mentioned in the previous episode, we talked about First Reformed, Paul Schrader, and his writing on the Transcendental Style. That movie, First Reformed, is very clearly influenced by Winter Light. Like some parallel storyline things happen there. So that's an interesting thing. If you saw First Reformed and enjoyed it, then you might would really have a lot to love about watching through some Bergman movies, especially Winter Light. And then I wanted to mention a couple other I kind of said earlier, but kind of a different genre, but modern filmmakers that talk a lot about Bergman is Ari Aster, who directed Hereditary and Midsommar, the horror movies, and then Robert Eggers, who made The Witch a few years ago, and then more recently The Lighthouse. And I think seeing, like, even to totally modern era, seeing the influence there is really strong. And they have a great podcast that I'll link to in the show notes, where they talk a lot about Bergman, and it's really fascinating to hear. But yeah, so he's a really influential person. I would say there's a lot to dig into. I've seen Wild Strawberries is another one of my favorites of his, that's I mentioned earlier as well, that is just very there's always kind of, for me, the ones I've seen, there's always this reflection on kind of life as a whole, and in a way that is really just beautiful and kind of poetic. And he also has some really funny movies. There's one called Smiles of a Summer Night, and it's basically like a sex comedy, but it's really a funny one, and I'll recommend that as well. And then what else have I seen? Through a Glass Darkly is an intense one. Actually, speaking of The Lighthouse, also I think some parallels there as far as being on an island and going mad a little bit. Winter Light, is the other that I'm really strongly connected with, about a minister and his experiences. So anyway, that's the ones I've seen so far, and I highly recommend all of them. So many of his films are streaming on the Criterion Channel, so that's another thing. If you want to dig into a bunch of his stuff, maybe do a free trial there and see if you like it. It's worth subscribing. There's so much good stuff there. But that's Bergman. He's a big name and for a reason, and really a beautiful storyteller, and one that I still have a lot to catch up with on him. But yeah, do you have any other thoughts on Bergman or on this film or anything else you wanted to mention in this discussion, Andrew?
I think the only thing would be, the film, while we've spoken about being somber in certain regards, is filled with some humor, is filled with light moments. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the film, we spoke about that the acting family kind of goes on through, as you said, the plague didn't kill everyone in Europe, in Sweden during this time. And people lived, people continued life. And I think Bergman probably personally needed this to make this film, but mm-hmm. also I think it is quite important during this time that we're experiencing, I think, the coronavirus and everything going on in the world, to see community as vital and important, and to do what we can for each other to make things a little bit better, like help, I think, provide some sort of connection that allows people to work through the difficulties in ourselves to move on in some way. And I really value that about Bergman's work. His later films also, I mean, there are very difficult sequences. There are scenes that are very just like heartbreaking at times, but there's this sense of human connection that is prized and valued. And as long as that can remain, then it seems like living and going forward is worth it. So yeah. I like
I love that. It's beautiful. Yeah. Well said. And I think that's a great place to end. So watch Seven Seal, watch some Bergman, and I think you'll find a lot to like. All right. Well, thanks so much again, Andrew, for joining us for this. I'm excited for next time. Let me look and see what the next movie is. I'm spacing right now on what it is. We are watching... Oh my gosh, next up is Stalker, which I've never seen, and I am excited to see from Andrei Tarkovsky. I've never seen anything by him. I know that they are quite the experience, his films, and that they're pretty dense, is from what I understand. So that'll be an interesting one to get into. I'll be watching that soon. Also on the Criterion channel, if you want to watch along. At least last time I checked, it was there, and so that's where I plan to watch it. But all right. Cool. Well, thanks, Andrew. And I guess we'll catch you next time.
All right. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah. Well, if you want to keep up with more Arthouse Garage things, go to arthousegarage.com, or we're pretty active on social media platforms. We are at Arthouse Garage on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd. And you can also find video reviews on YouTube, and written reviews and event coverage over at the blog at arthousegarage.com. Email me, Andrew, at arthousegarage.com. If you want to support the show, leave a rating or review on your podcast app. And you can also buy a t-shirt. We have some shirts at arthousegarage.com/shop. There's also an email newsletter that I've been doing just a lot of streaming recommendations right now, and that is arthousegarage.com/subscribe. So hit that up as well. And thank you so much for listening to this, and we will catch you next time. And until then, keep it snob free.